Hey, welcome to the Joe Scarborough Podcast. It is so great to have you here. I really, really appreciate you listening. We're going to talk about the United States, where we are, where we've been, where we're going over the next 20 years. Going to cover a lot of topics. I'm going to be talking to Mika Brzezinski. You may know her. I certainly know her very well. About the day that was what she's described as the worst day of her life, where she was able to still look up and see blue skies and be optimistic. And going to get to all of that, much more. And by the way, next podcast, I'm going to be talking to David Byrne. He, of course, of Talking Heads fame and also of American Utopia fame. One of the most original artists in rock music and certainly one of the most original artists on the music scene today. And that's coming up next week. And because I'm such a huge music fan, that's something I'm so excited about. And that's going to be dropping next Tuesday. I spent my weekend probably the way a lot of you spent your weekend. I was following the ceremonies and looking at the televised remembrances of September 11th. And, you know, those events obviously took on added weight to all of us because we were at the 20th anniversary. And it was also a time when we were reflecting on what happened over the past 20 years, what we got right, what we got wrong, and the ending of the Afghanistan war. It was really tough looking at the images of that day and replaying that moment in my mind. Because like you, if you were alive then or if you were old enough to remember, we all recall the moment where we were when 9/11 happened and recall the moment in our head when the old world ended and the new era that we're living in now began. But I saw hope then, even in the darkest of times, and I still do today. Now, this is not going to be a monologue about the last 20 years. I want to talk to you about the next 20 years. Because this past weekend, and I'll say the past month, well, hell, I'll say the last 20 years, it has been hard listening to pundits and talking heads and supposedly the smartest people in my business talk about the continued decline of the United States. And as hard as it was looking back over the last 20 years, it was even more troubling to me to hear the almost unanimous take about how much the United States has failed over the past two decades and how we'll forever, forever be trying to catch up because we've lost our standing across the globe. And I kept hearing how the next 20 years are going to be even more bleak, with American supremacy forever being eclipsed by a rising China or from Russia or from our own hand. Now, you're probably not going to agree with everything I say here. You may not even like what I say here. And I'm just guessing that because I'm not hearing anybody else saying it. But the takes that I heard this past weekend were so boringly predictable and so horribly wrong. You know why? This may piss you off. I don't know. But I'm just going to tell you the truth. This is the fact, whether you like it or not. The United States of America is stronger today than it's ever been. What? What did I? Did you just hear what I said? Oh my God, what's wrong with me? What? Not much, actually. Not much as far as this opinion goes. Just stay with me. Because even if you believe in the conventional wisdom you've been hearing that people have been shoving at you for the past month, coming from the Eeyore School of Foreign Policy, even if you believe that, just give me a second. And just open your mind and actually do something that a lot of people aren't doing right now. And that is, consider for a second that maybe the conventional wisdom is wrong. Now, I know facts don't matter a lot to people these days, but the facts and the numbers bear out what I'm saying about the United States. We are stronger economically, we're stronger militarily, we're stronger technologically, we're stronger culturally than any other country in the world. Looking at soft and hard power together, My God, there's not even a close second. Not China, not the EU, not Russia, not anybody. Now, I know that may be hard for you to believe, but just look up GDP. Google it. Go to your Google machine. And you'll find the United States of America's GDP is far ahead of everybody else. It's been going in a straight line up since the end of World War II, despite all of our fights, despite all the intramural battles between Republicans and Democrats, people on the left, people on the right, Fox News, MSNBC, blah, 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 blah. Despite all of that, it doesn't matter. We keep getting stronger economically every year, and it continues. Militarily, we could have a debate. Maybe we spend too much on our military. Maybe we don't have to spend more money than the next 14 countries combined. We can have that debate. But the one thing you can't debate is the fact that the United States of America is the strongest country militarily in the world. More on that later. Technologically, please, I'm not going to even waste my breath. It's not even a close call. Immigrants from across the world, the best and the brightest, the most brilliant, smartest minds of our time. They've left their countries, they've gone to Silicon Valley, and along with American natives, they have changed the world. And culturally, I'm sorry, everybody still wants to be here. Everybody loves American culture. Everybody still wants to move to the United States of America. And if you don't believe that, talk to an immigrant. Talk to an immigrant that just got here. And they will tell you that from where they come from, America's streets still are paved with gold. I know a lot of you don't want to hear that. We sit and we talk and we debate about how bad the United States of America is. And I get it. I get it. We do that for 3 hours a day on Morning Joe. We look at the people who've made mistakes, and we try to figure out how they can do better, how parties can do better, how this country can do better. Maybe that's why we keep getting better. But in being tough on ourselves, which we should be tough on ourselves, because we should expect the most from the United States of America. But sometimes by being too tough on ourselves, we miss the forest for the trees. Have we made mistakes over the last 20 years? Hell yeah. We should have killed Osama bin Laden when we had that shot in Tora Bora. That failure kept the top terrorist in the world alive for another decade. And the Iraq War, a complete debacle. A geopolitical tragedy, I'd say of historic scale. Think about it. We got WMDs wrong. We got de-bathification wrong. We screwed up by trying to build a Jeffersonian democracy in Iraq. And we guaranteed it with U.S. tax dollars and the blood of American servicemen and women. And after making remarkable progress in Iraq, from 2007 to 2010, we just up and left. And we created a power vacuum that ISIS would fill. We sat back as a country over the last 20 years while Assad slaughtered 500,000 in Syria, muttering to ourselves while we were sitting in a fetal position, there's nothing we can do. There's nothing we can do. Iraq went wrong, so there's nothing we can do. We did, though, start a war in Libya, and we deposed a leader who actually turned over his WMDs, thereby sending a very clear message to tyrants across the globe, don't give up your WMDs. No matter what we say, no matter what we ask you to do, because if you do, we'll kill you. Do you want to hear more? I could go on all day about the mistakes we've made over the last 20 years. I'm not wearing rose-colored glasses here. I saw us abandon our Kurdish allies after they put their lives on the line to help us destroy ISIS. I saw us bail out and retreat from Syria when 3,000 special ops forces stopped the Syrians, stopped ISIS, stopped Russia, stopped Iran, stopped Turkey from engaging in their worst behavior. And you remember a few minutes ago when I told you how militarily superior we were to the rest of the world? Well, when we had 3,000 troops in Syria, the Russians decided to try to attack our commandos. Only about 40, though, that were in a remote outpost. Well, that ended up being a bad management decision. American troops engaged in a brutal 4-hour firefight, and they ended up killing about 300 of those Russians that were attacking. And oh yeah, no American commandos were even hurt. But we bailed out of Syria, despite those 3,000 U.S. forces providing hope and protection to the Kurds and a safe space to Syrian refugees. We also crushed ISIS. We kept Iran and Russia in check. So it was in our national interest to stay there, but we retreated and we made another blunder. And then, of course, as you know, we left Afghanistan. And I understand, I'm in the minority here. Unlike Joe Biden and 75% of Americans, I thought we needed to keep a small fighting force there, not only to protect American interests, not only to protect our allies there, not only to stop the Taliban from feeding their most inhumane instincts, I also wanted to make it harder for terrorist networks to build up there and launch attacks against our homeland. You see, Afghanistan, like Syria, like Iraq, probably can't be built into a Jeffersonian democracy, and we shouldn't engage in nation building. I am not talking about the United States nation building. We can't do it. That's what we've learned over the last 20 years. But you know what else we've learned over the last 20 years? How to kill bad guys. How to kill terrorists. And how to stop terror networks from rebuilding. So we made mistakes. We've made a lot of mistakes. There's nothing jingoistic about my worldview. I know that two separate truths can exist side by side, and that's all I'm asking you here. To allow these two thoughts to exist side by side in your mind. That U.S. politicians can screw up time and again, like they have over the last 20 years on the international stage, and the United States of America can still be the nation that has fed and freed more people than any other country in world history. And that's why I'm so proud to be an American. That's why I'm so proud of what I've seen from Americans over the past few weeks. And I say this even though I disagreed with removing our troops from Afghanistan. What I've seen over the last month has highlighted both the greatness and the goodness of Americans. First, let's talk about our greatness. And yes, that's the word I use. When the United States of America did something over the last month that no other country ever could or ever would do. We airlifted 120,000 frightened souls out of Afghanistan, and we saved their lives. We saved their families' lives. We gave them a chance to start a new life away from the Taliban and away from the chaos of Afghanistan. As David Sanger at the New York Times noted, we basically airlifted the population of Billings, Montana. That was a feat every bit as inspiring as the Berlin Airlift, and it will be remembered for years as a monumental achievement in humanitarian aid. U.S. troops, they put their lives on the line. And 13 heroes paid the ultimate sacrifice for the tens of thousands of lives that they saved. One of those liberators was Marine Sergeant Nicole G. I'm sure you saw that shot. She was holding an Afghan baby in her arms, and she wrote on Afghanistan, by that picture, "I love my job." And of course she did. Duty, honor, courage. Those were not just words from an old speech. It was the creed they lived by every day. It's like the C-17 pilot who, as David Ignatius recounted, roared down a Kabul runway in a plane overloaded with 823 desperate Afghan evacuees. That's double its capacity. A nervous co-pilot, as they were rumbling down that runway, asked if the packed plane could lift off in that intense heat. The pilot answered, "Just watch me. Just watch me." It was a moment that took me back to the beginning of the war on terror, when Todd Beamer, of course, whispered those words, "Let's roll," on Flight 93, before they took it down in a field in Shanksville, Pennsylvania. As Carlos Lozada wrote in the Washington Post this past week, the passengers of that ill-fated flight quietly voted in the back of the plane on whether they were going to rush the cockpit and take their plane down to save American lives on the ground. As Lozada movingly wrote, they voted on it. They voted. Even in that moment of unfathomable fear and distress, those passengers took a moment to engage in the great American tradition of popular consultation before deciding to become the war's earliest soldiers. And Lozada asks at the end, was there ever any doubt to the outcome of that ballot? There wasn't. And just like we're hearing those stories of goodness of Americans from both sides of the aisle who are coming together to welcome these Afghan refugees to America's shores, I have no doubt that despite all of our failings, despite all of our flaws, despite all of the mistakes of the last 20 years, we as a nation will continue stumbling toward the light. Just watch us. I'll be right back. You know, growing up, my mom said that the best day of her life was, quote, when Joey learned to pour his own cereal. The reason she said that was, I was a cereal addict. I'd have it in the morning. I'd wake her up at 5 a.m, get my cereal. I'd still be eating it at night. I'd eat all the bad stuff, the Captain Crunch, the Trix, the Lucky Charms, just whatever was sugar-covered sugar, I would have. But, you know, we've all been trying to eat better. I'm trying to eat better, trying to have a healthy breakfast, and trying to do it without all the carbs. And I do that now with Magic Spoon. It's got great flavors that I love without all the bad stuff. It's got 0 grams of sugar, 13 to 14 grams of protein, and only 4 grams of carbs in each serving. Only 140 calories a serving. It's keto-friendly. It's gluten-free, it's grain-free, it's soy-free, and it's low-carb. Plus, they got a variety pack. The 4 flavors are cocoa, fruity, frosted, and peanut butter, my favorite. They're great flavors. They're healthy. They're delicious. Plus, you can mix them up. I mix cocoa and peanut butter together. It tastes just like a peanut butter cup. It also tastes like the regular cereal I had from my childhood, but it's really nutritious. It's great. It's really healthy, and it brings joy to your mornings. Or if you're like me, your afternoons, your evenings, whenever you eat cereal. So this is what you do. Go to magicspoon.com/gojo and grab a variety pack. Try it out today and make sure to use our promo code GOJO at checkout to save $5 on your order. And Magic Spoon's so confident in their product, it's backed with a 100% happiness guarantee. So if you don't like it for any reason, they'll refund the money, no questions asked. Remember, get your delicious bowl of guilt-free cereal at magicspoon.com/gojo and use the code GOJO to save $5. And thanks so much, Magic Spoon, for sponsoring this episode. Hey, welcome back. I have a very special guest. First time in the 47-year history of this podcast that she's ever come on. So this is really really special. I think it means I've finally broken through. This podcast has finally made the big time. I'm talking, of course, about Mika Brzezinski. Mika, thank you for being here.
It's your first podcast. I've been happy to be here.
I've been doing this for 47 years. Okay. Sweetie. Yeah. 47 years. It's like my first guest was Bing Crosby. It was right after he and David Bowie. I don't even know if those years match up, but it was a very moving podcast. This is more moving. More moving than Bowie, more moving than Bing Crosby, So it's so great to have you here. So I want to ask you this for you. We talked the first segment. I was talking about the last 20 years a little bit, but also talked about moving forward and what happens over the next 20 years. I know this is something I wish we could talk to your dad because, of course, your dad, National Security Advisor for 4 years, led the opening of China, the Camp David Accords. I know that he would have so many things to say about it. But I just I want people to hear a little bit about you. And a side of you that that many people didn't know about until this past week. On Friday, when we remembered 9/11, you were actually talking about being a reporter and running down the West Side Highway with your shoes off and getting down at Ground Zero, and about the tragedy that you saw unfolding. But a lot of people were surprised, didn't know that actually that you were a reporter. So tell us about that. How long were you a reporter before Morning Joe?
Oh, my gosh. I started out in local in Hartford, Connecticut, 15 years, and then went to anchor the overnight broadcast at CBS News. 3 years, and then hopped on to MSNBC to do a three-hour show in the middle of the afternoon, 2 years, and then got a job as a CBS correspondent. Can you see a thread here? CBS, MSNBC, CBS, MSNBC.
Yeah,
but I got a job to be a correspondent at CBS News, where I worked for almost 8 years.
Now, was 9/11 your first day?
I think it was my second day as a correspondent. Yeah.
And you walked into CBS, and what happened?
I walked into CBS, and I'd been given advice. I'd talked a little bit with Byron Pitts, the kind of top reporter there. And his advice was to come in early, because chances are if you come in early, you get it, you know, first grab at the first story that might cross the wire that day or whatever. Just be there first and hopefully get chosen first to be on the CBS Evening News. And I started coming in at 7. And I was just in my office and watched on CNN, actually, when the first plane hit, and it just everyone was surmising that it was this or that. But I thought, well, whatever it is, maybe I'll cover it. So I ran downstairs and was sent off and running down the West Side Highway. And the reason for that is because it was gridlock in New York City. Things were getting very out of hand. You know, the fire was getting worse in the towers. And at some point, the second plane hit. And it was chaos.
And you were actually running down. I know that this for you, like so many reporters that witnessed all of this, you all don't like to talk about it. And I know you haven't liked to talk about it for 20 years. You've talked to some other friends, though, that were down there who opened up for the first time. Now and they said they didn't like talking about it, but whenever they did, they started breaking down, crying.
Yeah,
that happened to you in an interview. You weren't even expecting it.
The
first time you had opened up. I think it was to Elle magazine.
Yeah,
and you got a couple of words out, and then you just broke down and started crying.
I know. I think I scared the reporter. I didn't expect to do this, and I think just to sort of back up a little bit, a lot of the people I know who were down there, of course, are reporters, and for us. You know, the reason we didn't feel comfortable talking about it is that it's just not about us.
Right.
At all.
No,
and,
not at all.
You know, that's sort of the number one rule as a journalist is to not become or feel like you're part of the story. But on top of it, there was the weight of, you know, 3,000 people died that day and we were witness to that. And you just feel really, really, really strange talking about your experience that day when the weight of those families is far, far heavier. And so I, for many reasons, had not talked about it at great length on our show or with people.
Right.
But for the 20th anniversary, I just felt like that was the one time that I would definitely tell my story and hear others share their stories. It seems like a lot of people felt the same way, that was the day that they could maybe add to the historic context of the day. And each reporter's version of what they went through is important. There were a lot of local reporters who were down there who I knew really, really well. And, you know, their stories are incredible. And what we were trying to do that day was very hard. And I think we all feel like, oh, maybe there was something more we could have done because there was so much loss. And we were sitting there helpless as to how to make anything better for anyone. It was the most helpless, hopeless day of our lives.
You know, we saw, I heard you talking to other friends about what put you in a trance, and mm-hmm. you finally talked about it on the show, but I've heard this mm-hmm. over and over again. From reporters who were down there, and also by just New Yorkers that were down there watching. And it was people jumping from the buildings. Mm-hmm. And it's so interesting that your reaction was the same reaction I've heard from so many people that were down at Ground Zero before the buildings fell. And that was they saw flicks jumping off the building, coming off the building, flickers of light, mm-hmm. and they couldn't grasp that it was human beings. They couldn't grasp that it was men and women that were jumping off the top of the World Trade Center. And it seems like not only were so many people in a trance then, but they'd quietly talk about it, but not talk about it on television. It was something that haunted them mm-hmm. For 20 years.
Yeah, I know a lot of people who really struggled after that day. And, of course, I mean, it's to witness that. And I think the trance that you are referring to, the trance that I talk about even for myself, is that I think that's the moment where everybody, all of us, standing there craning our necks in horror, frozen, watching this play out, that's the moment all of us collectively knew that it was so bad in there that that's what was happening. And, you know, I had this kind of flash in my mind, like the building appears to be kind of swaying. I feel like it's moving. And God, I mean, could it fall down? And I remember actually kind of saying to myself, that's crazy, like almost slapping myself across the face saying, that's just really ridiculous thought. But everything that started to happen after we saw those flickers was the unthinkable. People who thought jumping was the way to get away from whatever was going on in there is still like this endless, constant tunnel of horror in my mind as to what must have been going on in there. And I can't get out of that when I go there in my mind. But secondly, then
you froze, right? You froze, and then the next unthinkable of horror happened.
Yeah, the building began to crumble underneath itself, top down, and it's just.
You were there with Byron Pitts?
Actually, believe it or not, somehow I ran down there and I was right up against the towers and I was standing and I felt like someone was familiar next to me, sort of right next to me. And I turned over and it's Byron Pitts, the guy who told me to come in early. At some point, he said, we got to get out of here. And he grabbed my hand and pulled me away and we started running. It was very chaotic and dove behind a car, crawled around, and, you know, trying to get away from this rolling plume of debris just kind of barreling towards us. And we ended up in a school, and it was totally dark by the time we were in the school because the debris had caught up with us and it made everything dark. And we were looking for a landline and looking for, I don't know, I found some boots. I had no shoes on for the whole time. And so I put on some work boots that I found in a bin of clothes that they were giving away at the school. And they were trying to get the kids out of the school. We were trying to find a landline. We got on the air. And the rest is, you know, part of CBS News history. We were on the air for a long time after that. And I stayed down there for weeks. But it was, you know, I was listening to your remarks at the beginning of the podcast about this country. And I will tell you that I didn't lose hope in this country on that day. And it was a really hopeless day with so many people who went to work on such a beautiful, wonderful, bright, vivid, brand new day. Those days in September in New York City are of the most gorgeous of the year. Kids are starting school. My daughter Amelia it was her first week of kindergarten. She had a uniform at St. Joseph's School in Bronxville. She was so excited to go. And Carly was 3. And there was an election that day. And it's just one of those, like, you feel better about work. You want to, like, buy new shoes and, you know, start over again. And just, it's a beginning type of day in September in New York City. And I'm always triggered, actually, by that kind of blue sky now. And I always think of 9/11. And I just stop myself and pray and show gratitude and feel grateful that I'm here. And I got to live with my family and, you know, see my children grow up. That's what I think whenever I see a sky like that. But back to the hope. I didn't lose it that day because of the, I think, strength of this country, of the experiment that is this democracy. I knew it was strong, and I knew it would come back, and I knew we would be okay. We would never, ever, ever not feel the burden of the loss of that day. But I felt it all around me. I felt it in New Yorkers who just sort of all jumped in. I felt it in those firefighters who I was face to face with as they walked into the gates of hell to go back into those towers. They came into the school to take a break and go back in. And in the weeks after, I saw it in the American flags that were hanging outside windows of New York City apartments. And I just, I never hated a story so much, but loved our country so much.
Yeah.
And it's just a very remarkable time.
Yeah.
For the country.
Well, you didn't lose hope then. We shouldn't lose hope now. Thank you so much, Mika.
Thanks for having me. I know it was very hard to book me for this.
I know. Thank you for taking time out and talking so personally about that. We'll be right back. This podcast is sponsored by BetterHelp. Is there something interfering with your happiness or preventing you from achieving your goals? I can tell you for Mika and me and members of my family, we've actually started doing DBT, and it's made all the difference in the world because that's what we needed. Now, BetterHelp will assess your needs and match you with your own licensed professional therapist, and you can start communicating in under 48 hours. Now this isn't a crisis line, and this is not self-help. It's a professional therapy done securely online, and there's a broad range of expertise available, which may not be locally available to you in many areas. I'm telling you, it's a godsend. This service is available in your hometown and for clients worldwide. You can log into your account anytime and send a message to your therapist. You'll get timely and thoughtful responses. Plus, you can schedule weekly video or phone sessions so you won't ever have to sit in an uncomfortable waiting room as with traditional therapy. BetterHelp is committed to facilitating great therapeutic matches, so they make it easy and free to change therapists if that's what you need. It's more affordable than traditional offline therapy, and financial aid is available. BetterHelp wants you to start living a happier life today. Visit their website and read their testimonials that are posted daily. Visit BetterHelp.com/Gojo. That's BetterHelp. and join the over 2 million people who've taken charge of their mental health with the help of an experienced professional. In fact, so many people have been using BetterHelp that they are recruiting additional therapists in all 50 states. And you get a special offer from the Joe Scarborough Podcast. You get 10% off your first month at BetterHelp.com/GoJoe. You know, Mika talked about finding hope in a day that was filled with hopelessness. Being able to look up at the billowing smoke that was coming from the worst attack on our homeland in American history, and yet still being able to see through that smoke, through that dust, through that deadly haze, and still view the blue skies above. And to still know, to still believe, to still have faith that the United States of America would find its way through that day. I felt the same way. Even though I was in Pensacola, Florida, and she was at Ground Zero, I felt the same way, like I'm sure you did as well, because I believe in this country, I believe in its exceptionalism, and I believe in the America that, well, that never was, but the America that we must be, to borrow a line from Langston Hughes. You know, I spent a lot of my adult life telling everybody around me that everything was going to work out just fine. When Bill Clinton got elected, I had to tell my parents that we would survive as a republic. When George W. Bush got elected, I had to tell my Democratic friends the same thing. When Barack Obama got elected, good Lord, I had to convince my friends and relatives, my parents, my family members, we would survive. I had to convince others that Sharia law would not be enacted in Oklahoma. Or whatever other state they said it was going to be enacted. It's crazy. And when the Tea Party got elected 2 years later, good Lord, my Democratic friends, many of them, I had to get them out of a fetal position and let them know, we're going to be fine. There are elections every 2 years. And sure enough, in 2012, Barack Obama got reelected. And then 2 years later, Republicans did well. I mean, so there was always a great balance. Every election is not the last election. That's what we've always known, that our democratic institutions were going to hold. And so I was always optimistic. I will say that for the first time in my adult life over the past few years, I have been far more concerned. And I must admit that the first time I wondered whether we actually would get through the challenges that we were facing was over the last few months after January the 6th. After a day that, remarkably enough, there were most members of both parties going to the floor and condemning those actions on that day, but some pulling back in the months following. It's really been shocking to me. And I remember last year or the year before on the 9/11, I talked about some of the constitutional challenges, the challenges to our constitutional norms, how I was more concerned about that than I was about the attacks on 9/11, because I knew we would get through the attacks on 9/11. And I got absolutely hammered that day, but it was on Twitter, so it really didn't count. I didn't care. But after January the 6th, all of my concerns about constitutional norms being challenged, federal judges' authority being challenged, our intel community being attacked, the media being called enemies of the people, all of these Stalinistic phrases being thrown at members of the media. I did start to get concerned and started thinking, in contrast to my hopefulness after 9/11, started thinking back to what Abraham Lincoln said in his Lyceum address, because it seemed so relevant, and it's relevant now. And I just want to read a little bit of it to you, because it's really the challenge for our time. And Lincoln somehow is always relevant. He said, "Shall we expect some transatlantic military giant to step the ocean and crush us at a blow? Never. all the armies of Europe, Asia, and Africa combined, with a treasure of the earth in their military chest, with a Bonaparte for a commander, could not by force take a drink from the Ohio River or make a track on the Blue Ridge in a trial of 1,000 years. At what point, then, is the approach of danger to be expected? "I answer," said Lincoln, "if it ever reach us, it must spring up amongst us. It cannot come from abroad. If destruction be our lot, we must ourselves be its author and finisher. As a nation of free men, we must live through all time or die by suicide." You know, Lincoln would give his own life to keep our country together. 650,000-700,000 Americans would die in the Civil War. And still at the end of that war, Lincoln talked about us moving forward with malice toward none. I'll admit to you, that remains a great challenge to me. A great challenge for Mika, a great challenge for so many of my friends who see fellow Americans that we've known our entire life siding with illiberal forces that just do not respect democratic institutions unless their candidate wins every election and their side is affirmed by every court. They don't respect the press unless that media outlet reconfirms all of their conspiracy theories, all of their pre-existing beliefs, and all of their pre-existing prejudices. I do. Despite all of this, I remain optimistic about our future, and I can see blue skies through the smoke and still take hope from above. But I know you know this. I feel it. I know you feel it. Just like Mika, I see storm clouds that have been gathering on the horizon for the past few years. And I know that we have much more work to do together to make sure that America remains the last best hope for this dying world. And I think back to, you know, Flight 93. I think back to the sacrifices that we talked about last week. And I think we all have a responsibility as we move forward through the next 20 years. We can make it better. As the old Chicago song went, we can make it better, we can do better, we can demand more of our leaders, we can make the next 20 years America's greatest 20 years. Now, you may believe that's jingoistic, it's fine. You may believe that's overly optimistic, I get it, I get it. There are a lot of reasons to look up into that sky and see the smoke. All I've been asking you today is just to look a little closer. To look through that smoke and try to find the blue sky behind it. Because it's there. Hey, thank you so much for being with me on the podcast. Mika says it's my first. I think I've been around 47, 48 years doing this. But thank you for being here on the first podcast. You're going to love next podcast. Great. We've got David Byrne. So make sure you keep your eyes and ears out for that. We'll talk to you soon. I'm Joe Scarborough. Thanks so much for listening.